New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we will be exploring two questions. What is Armageddon and how do angels fit in? My guest is Charles Upton. His first two books of poetry, Panic Grass in 1968 and Time Raid in 69, were published by City Lights in San Francisco, known for publishing the works of the great beat poets. And he was really only a high school student then and considered the youngest member of the beat generation. He subsequently became engaged in metaphysics and the traditionalist movement and is author of many books, including Folk Metaphysics, Mystical Meanings in Traditional Folk Songs and Spirituals, Knowings in the Arts of Metaphysics, Cosmology and the Spiritual Path, The System of the Antichrist, Truth and Falsehood in Postmodernism and the New Age, The Alien Disclosure Deception, The Metaphysics of Social Engineering, and Vectors of the Counter-Initiation, The Course and Destiny of Inverted Spirituality. Charles is based in Lexington, Kentucky, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Charles. Once again, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Very glad to be here.
And I'm glad you're still here. I know you've been struggling with cancer, so I regard every opportunity to have a conversation with you as a blessing.
It seems to be just in a latent state, and thank God I don't have any symptoms, you know. So, well, next time I go back to get checked out, we will see what's been going on. So.
And once again, I'll let our viewers know, if they look in the description of this video, we will include a link to your GoFundMe page.
Yeah, I very much appreciate that. Yeah, and now I'm having to pay for getting rid of raccoons in my attic and repairing raccoon damage, which is pretty expensive. That's another. You can't start a GoFundMe for that. I might sneak some of this and pay these bills that are pouring in. You know.
Raccoons can be a problem. They're such cute creatures, but then they have this mask. They look like bandits.
Yeah, and they're awfully smart. You know, I mean, I think animals are just as smart in doing what they have to do to get through their lives as we are in our lives. Maybe smarter because they have fewer distractions.
Well, today we'll be talking about Armageddon, which is a word that is almost part of pop culture these days.
Everybody is talking about war of one kind or another these days. I mean, it's interesting that this interview was delayed a little bit to give somebody time to shoot Trump in the ear, you know, which just sets the stage perfectly. The conflict. And, you know, people are talking about World War III. People are talking about a civil war in this country, and, you know, and conflict seems to be coming to the fore on every conceivable level, you know? So it behooves us to ask, I mean, the Battle of Armageddon is supposed to be the big battle, the final battle, and I would say the real battle, you know, the one where the stakes are as close to absolute as you can get, even beyond the questions of survival or not, because there are things more absolute than survival. And so, you know, we should try to come to a clear enough conception of what the real battle is. I mean, there are people who, you know, China, Russia, the United States, you know, they can't, these people cannot not imagine a greater battle, well, than to use Alexander Dugin's terminology, between the Eurasian heartlanders of the great Asian continent and you know, the sleazy Atlantean mercantile empires, you know, of the West. That's how he, you know, and that's his picture of, you know, the ultimate war. You know, I mean, even World War One, you know, they were talking about, you know, Woodrow Wilson was saying the war to end all wars, as if, as if that there could be such a thing, unless it ends all the people who would ever fight in a war. I guess that's the end of, you know. But so what is the real war? You have to look at it on a spiritual level if you want to get the ultimate picture of what the final battle would be. And beyond that, though, we have to start with the sense that there is something greater than conflict. Conflict isn't the be-all and end-all, the final definition of everything. I mean, as the Hindus say, Brahman, who is the absolute God, the absolute, is beyond the dvandvas, which are the pairs of opposites, good and evil, truth and falsehood. You know, the ultimate reality is greater than all of that. So, and so this means that, which you might put it this way, God is not going to fight in this battle. He is beyond the battle. So the battle has to do with whether we as a human race can place ourselves in line of the spiritual influences coming from God, or whether we will go in another way. That's the battle. But from God's point of view, he is, you know, an observer. You know, he is looking on and saying, okay, I've set the stage, I've set the terms, now let's see how you guys do. You know, he knows how we will do, but in other words, he's the observer. He's not, you know, someone we can call upon, fight on our side. Everybody who has some belief in spiritual power wants to get the spiritual power to fight on their side, or fight on the side of what they consider to be the true and the good. And sometimes the true and the good is just me against the world. You know, I want God to fight for me against the bastards out there that are screwing with me. You know, that's the very little, very small idea of what Armageddon would be. We need a much bigger idea than that, and something bigger than civil war, and something bigger than World War III. So what is the real battle? That's the question.
May I ask you a question? Because I know you're a Muslim, and I know that the term Armageddon is pretty specific to the Christian Bible.
That word is, but according to Muslim doctrine, at the end of the age, Jesus, who was considered to be a prophet, not the son of God, the prophet Jesus, will return to slay the Antichrist. That's there. There's a lot of pretty canonical material in Hadith about that battle, how it's going to work out. It'll start in Damascus and such will happen. The Antichrist, who is called Al-Dajjal, will have these characteristics, and he'll be blind in one eye, and he'll wear a green turban, and he'll do this. And, you know, this the mythological and yet highly significant material about the final battle. And that's one way that Islam does have, in other words, a final battle as well, under a different name. And also, the Sufis, when they talk about the greatest battle, or the greater struggle, the greater jihad, this is the struggle within ourselves against the forces that menace our integrity. You know, that's the inner war, and it's a greater war. It's a greater war than any outer war, because that's why it's called the greater jihad. People, I think, there are people who want to go to war in the outer world and even get killed because they don't want to face the inner war because it's so much hotter than merely going out on the street and shooting people and getting shot in return, you know, or going, you know, into war, you know, in the forces of some nation. You know, that's cool. You know, you live until you die, and then when you're shot, it's all over. But the intimacy and the power and the rigor of the greater jihad is so formidable that people run to enlist in some war or other so they don't have to face it. So obviously they're fighting the greater jihad in projected form. Those people over there represent the forces that are menacing my integrity, not something in me, but those people. You know, and so all I have to do is kill as many of them as I can, and I'm doing the right thing. So the greater jihad is greater than any outer war. On the other hand, it has reflections in the world. It's not like just all psychological. It's happening within you. But certainly, if you, you know, understand what that war is and take the right, you know, make the right commitments, you know, you may well find that those commitments will have an expression and will confront you with certain duties in dealing with the world. But, you know, it has to start with, you know, with what is within you. And so what I say, if I want to simply define what Armageddon is, what the ultimate war is, there are forces which are certainly within each of us, but they are within the world, obviously, which are essentially inimical to humanity. They want the destruction of humanity, whether they want to kill all of us or turn all of us into transhumanist robots or do whatever it is that will destroy, will violate and destroy our humanity. They are dedicated to doing that. And so it is incumbent upon us to name them, to recognize them, and to say, no, I will not have my humanity destroyed. And I will not participate in anything collectively that would lead to that same outcome. You know, we must preserve our humanity. There are people who say, you know, well, human, oh, well, it's humanity has had an interesting run, but maybe now we'll be hybridized with the aliens, or we'll be transhumanist, you know, cyborgs or something, and we'll move on from there. You got to maintain your humanity. Stay human. You want a banner to raise in the Battle of Armageddon. The words "Stay human" are on that banner. That's it. Now, how that works out, what, you know, serves our humanity and what violates our humanity, people disagree on that. You know, I mean, certainly, you know, the liberal Democrats believe that what they're doing, up to a point, besides their all cynicism and skullduggery aside, you know, there's a core of belief that what we're doing is in service to humanity. And the same thing with the conservatives or the MAGA people or the Trumpists or whoever they are serving humanity. You know, the man who says, or man or woman who says, I am serving humanity by saying that a woman has a right to control her own body and her destiny and in terms of reproduction, and no one can walk into her and, you know, life and tell her she can't have an abortion if there's many reasons for that, and this would be destructive to her, and, you know, and so we're defending humanity, and the people on the other side of the abortion issue will say, what about the poor little child who he's may not be fully developed yet, but he is a little human life. Does he have no rights at all? He or she, you know, they're killing babies, and we've got to stop. Now, both of these are quasi-absolute positions, which you can see the rationale for each one. You know, I mean, in terms of we're serving humanity, we're serving the human integrity. So how do you solve something like that? Well, what I say is, where does the essence of our humanity reside? It resides in God, in the mind of God. God knows. God made us. He maintains us. He has sent teachers and avatars and prophets in order to save us and to teach us. And he knows what he is up to in this thing called humanity. The perfect design of what the human being is rests within him, within his mind and in his heart and his reality. And we can't see that completely. You know, that's God's knowledge of who we are, and our knowledge of who we are is always going to be partial. His knowledge is perfect and absolute and eternal. He knows what the human form is and why he put us here. You know, I always like to tell the story, I'm sure I've told this before, from the Quran, where this is Allah and Adam. Adam represents humanity. You know, he's the essence of humanity. And Allah tells Adam the names of all things. And then he goes and he says, now, he takes Adam before the angels and he says, now tell the angels their names. And the angels themselves didn't even know their names. The angels are the archetypes of all things, but they don't know themselves in the same comprehensive way that the human being in potential can know. And so Adam informed them of their own names, you know. So that is the preeminence of Adam. And then there's the story that then Allah says to all the angels, well, bow down to Adam. He knew your names. He's got the knowledge. You didn't have the knowledge, so make obeisance to him. And all the angels did except Iblis, who was to become the Muslim Satan. And he said, yeah, I'm going to bow down to this guy. You know, I am created of smokeless flame, which means he was of the jinn, you know. And this being is created of the mud of the earth. I'm not going to bow down. So, you know, he was cast out, but he was allowed, you know, he said, give me some time and I'll be able to screw with your precious human race. You know, Allah, you know, just try me. You see, you will see just how great these people are that you have put so much stock in. And Allah says, all right, I'll give you time. You know what will finally happen to you, but I'll give you time to screw with the human race, and we'll see what happens. And this is very much like the book of Job. It's really, that's in Christianity pretty much as well. And so he says to the angels, well, I'm about to send Adam down to earth to become my representative and my viceroy on earth. And the angels say, We hate to question what you're doing, because after all, you're God and you know everything. And yet we have some insight into what's going to happen. You know what he's going to do down there, don't you? He's going to shed blood. He's going to do terrible things. And you're going to place him, you know, as your representative on earth. You know, please, you know, can you explain? And all he said was, I know something that you don't. See, so that's the preeminence of the human form. And so if we're going to defend the human form, we will have to go beyond our conceptions of what human integrity and human reality is. We will have to turn to absolute reality and say, somewhere within the mind of God is the knowledge of what the human being is and our great preeminence and our great significance in God's plan for the universe. So, you know, we place ourselves under the allegiance to that conception. Even if we don't understand it fully, we hope to understand it better as we go along, but we don't know what God is up to. It was up to in creating us. We just know it really meant a lot to him. So, you know, we will, you know, be servants of his perfect conception of us, even if we don't fully understand what that is. Now, once you make that commitment, and that takes some doing to get there, because you have to, you know, release or at least see the limitations of every other conception you have of who you are and what is going on in the universe, you know, and just say, you know, whatever God, you know, whatever his purpose for creating us, you know, that's what I stand for. So I stand in wait. I am ready to be used by him in the service of that conception and in the service of my own integrity. Once you do that, it's a long way to get there. But once you do that, what will happen? Everything that is against that commitment is going to pop up. It's going to pop up in your soul, in your, you know, in your inner life. It's going to throw itself at you from the world. You know, the horrible things that are being done to the human race on every level. I mean, you know, Elon Musk, you know, places electrodes in our brains. And so maybe we'll all get electrodes in our brains and be connected with computers. That'll be so much easier. You know, we won't have to mess with, you know, keyboards and all this crap. But, you know, we'll just be connected. You know, and obviously this is the destruction of the human race. After that, we will no longer be fully human. And can we ever come back from that? I sincerely doubt it, although who knows? Maybe we can. Alien implants have been removed by surgeons from human beings, and maybe you can get rid of those. Will insurance pay for your Neuralink to be removed? I don't know. It's another question. But what attacks against us? And everybody with a different political or religious viewpoint has another version of what's attacking and destroying humanity. They're all, some of them, they're similar, but a lot of them are, you know, they're different, you know. You know, like the left wing concentrates on a particular kind of evil that it sees. It doesn't want, you know, would be the fate worse than death if it happens to us. And the right wing concentrates on another kind of evil, which will be the fate worse than death. And all, we got to look at all of these, but realize that the real stakes are on a higher plane, and submit ourselves to them to serve our own integrity as God has created us, whether we even understand what that is fully. So that is the battle of Armageddon.
It's been a topic that people, particularly in the Christian world, but I'm sure elsewhere, have been discussing for many, many generations, for eons. And I recently had a guest who pointed out, for example, that back in the 1300s or so, when the printing press was developed, people thought that was going to rob us of our humanity.
Each of these things might have robbed us of a little of our humanity. I mean, even writing, you know, even the first writing, I'm sure people were saying, you know, but you know, the human memory is so magnificent. We can memorize, you know, in entire epics and cosmologies, you know, and the bard will have this at his fingertips or at the tip of his tongue, and he will know all this. But when we start writing things down, it will dumb everybody down. You know, it's not the problem was not illiteracy in those days. The problem was literacy. You know, and that's why, particularly the Sunni Muslims concentrate so much on saying the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, was illiterate. You know, he heard this, you know, the Quran directly from the angel Gabriel, from Allah through the angel Gabriel, and memorized it. And you know, it became part of his, you know, the store of his lore, and he, you know, it was written down later. But you know, this wasn't automatic writing; it wasn't dictated to him, so he should write it. He heard it directly, so it's a more intimate and more complete knowledge that comes directly. You know, that's why I like to phone people instead of texting them, you know, because so much more gets through than if you just, you know, text. And so every one of these things, oh, you know, the printing press is a, you know, it's of the devil, and or writing itself is of the devil. Well, that's the way it's always been. You know, the more we, you know, develop various technologies, the less we are in ourselves. And we have to say this is inevitable. You know, I mean, here we are using computers in cyberspace. We can't say, you know, we're you know, this is a mortal sin, and we're, you know, obviously this is what you do. This is where we are. But we have to recognize how something is lost every single time. You know, and there's so the human stature was so exalted that it took eons to whittle us down to this level. So everybody who said stop, it's, you know, this is of the devil. You know, do not use this terrible technology. They were right, but on the other hand, what they didn't admit at the same time was that is the course of things. You know, the human, and this is what René Guénon talked about in the course of the cycle of manifestation, the world age, the manvantara. Things descend from the plane of essence, from the essential pole, which is more spatial and where you are in the world of eternal forms, you know, and time is hardly a ripple on the face of eternity. And here are the eternal forms, and as the world age, the manvantara goes ahead, it comes down and down. The time becomes more dominant and starts going faster and faster. And, you know, and now I look at AI ads and they say, you know, our system will allow you to process vast amounts of information faster than ever before. Well, great. You know, if we got to do it, we got to do it. But is that, you know, the serenity, the perfection, the elevation of silent contemplation of the eternal forms? No. More and more information. Of course, most of the information nowadays is false. It's inaccurate or it's a lie. So processing more of it is a questionable good, you know? So, yeah, people say, the world can't end because people have been set in the year 1000 because of those big round numbers, you know, this must be the end of the world. Worlds were ending all along, you know, and everybody was right, you know, but there will come a time, and we can see how we have so many ways to end all life on Earth, you know. There will come a time where that question, is this the end of the world, will no longer be asked, because there will be nobody to ask it. You know, that's how we'll know that was really it. But on the other hand, we're here for a reason. This is the other thing about the Battle of Armageddon. You make an absolute commitment to maintaining your human integrity. And yet the destruction of all things around you, you know, the degeneration of the eon, the generation of humanity, the generation of nature, all of this is lawful. This is the way things go. This is cosmic entropy. That's the way it goes. And you know, God produces a perfect form of the universe in his heart and his mind, releases it into dimensional existence, and as soon as he does that, it spreads out. It manifests. It expands. It goes into various, you know, different manifestations, and it slowly, you know, goes to lower and lower levels. It gets more complex, more obscure, and down and down. And that's just the way it is. That's what happens when you create something in an external way. You give it over to external forces, and it, you know, it doesn't have its original purity. That's if you won't allow for that, you'll say, well, God, this should never have created the universe. He should never have created me. I'm sorry anything ever happened. That's what the Gnostics of late antiquity said, you know, and that's heretical or wrong. You know, there's a reason, there's a mysterious reason for all this. And like Paul said, I know something that you don't know.
I have a question for you. It came up actually about an hour ago when I was having lunch with a friend. And we were discussing similar matters, and he pointed out that there's a big emphasis within Islam to memorize the Quran and to hold it, the entire Quran in your memory, in Arabic, I presume. And the reason my friend told me that this was done is because it was thought that the jinns are so mischievous, they will come and try and distort the written text. But as long as people have the original Quran in their memory, they won't be deceived by the tricks played by the jinns.
Well, there's something to that, because Islam looks at the earlier scriptures, which you know, the Torah and the Gospel are taken as legitimate scriptures, but it is said they were, you know, they're not in their original purity. They've been edited and changed, and you know, it's the jinns or it's you know, human beings with various interests that they want to put forward, and so I mean, it's obvious. It's interesting to have four Gospels and see their similarities and differences and all this, but this is not from the horse's mouth. You know, this is later renditions of the original story. Recently, those I forget who it was, but I got some email it was maybe something on YouTube where the earliest written form of the Quran that has ever been discovered was recently discovered, and it was shown that the text that is accepted as the Quran today was substantially identical with the earliest written form. So we can say at least that the degeneration of the direct word of God has been a lot less within Islam than in other traditions. Because the other traditions, they're not supposed to be so much the direct word of God, particularly in Christianity. The revelation is not the New Testament. The revelation is Christ. He is the original text, if you will. And the other, you know, the Gospels, the Epistles, these are commentaries on or stories about the original revelation. They may be maybe inspired, and they are, you know, and that they have a lot of truth to them, but they're not the original thing. Whereas in Islam, the original thing is the very word of the Quran. Now, Muhammad is not the revelation. Muhammad is the channel of the revelation. The revelation itself is the ayat, the verses of the Quran. So that's the Muslim picture. But so anyway, the question is how. Oh, war. I mean, you can just say, oh, I don't want to think about it. I'll hide it under my bed. Or if you've got a little more initiative, you may go crazy and buy a gun and start shooting at presidential candidates. You know, what I'm saying is the way to participate in the Battle of Armageddon, first, we have to give up all of our own agendas. And some of those agendas, we spent our lives developing them, saying, this is what I think is true. This is what I think what needs to be done. I would give my life, you know, to see this conception of things or this way that things could be to further that conception. You know, I will sacrifice, you know, that's not enough. We have to say, we don't know what God wants ultimately. Is particularly in this moment, you know, in terms of the larger situation of humanity on earth, we can make certain statements about what God's will appears to be in relationship to us. But it's not this immediacy of, you know, how do I respond? Everything is going to hell. And if I'm not supposed to just hide and totally distract myself and live in a world of pornography, video games, and drugs, or however people distract themselves. If I'm not going to do that, if I'm going to face it and meet the challenge, how do I do that? Because it's so easy to lose your mind, you know, to make some choice that will just make things worse, you know. And so that's why people don't, you know, W.B. Yeats said it perfectly in his poem, The Second Coming. You know, he said, you know, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with passionate intensity. But we can't do, you don't want to be filled with passionate intensity and become a psychopathic killer in the name of the good, right? But you don't. It's no good to lack all conviction either, because that's too bad. You know, we need to love the truth, to know the truth to the best of our ability, and to be convicted of our duty to live by and into that truth. We need the conviction, but the conviction can't come from our own minds, from our own conceptions. We have to say, God, what is your will at, you know, in general, of course, but in this moment, what do you want? Now, if we can really say that, and there's a lot of layers, you know, you think you're saying that, then you find, uh-oh, I was just pushing one of my own agendas that I hadn't quite realized I had yet, you know, and there's many layers to that onion. But if you can get to that essential thing, what is your will? Then it's possible, I claim, to bring the angels in to the story, into the situation. Because now, the other thing with angels, now this is one of the things I was going to read. We can get to angels. And this is by Rainer Maria Rilke, German Romantic poet. His masterpiece was called the Duino Elegies. He had 10 elegies. And these had to do, oh, there was magnificent poetry. And they have very much to do with angels. And this is the first lines of the first of the 10 elegies. He says, "Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the angelic orders? And if my call did ascend, if I were gathered to the glory of some incandescent heart, my own faint flame of being would fail in its glare. For beauty is nothing but the beginning of a terror that we are still just able to bear. And the reason we revere it so is because it calmly disdains to destroy us. Every angel is terrible." Now, you know, that gets rid of the idea that angels are, you know, I want something nice after all this pain, all this struggle, all this rigor and looking at darkness and struggle. Can't we have a nice angelic influence which will, you know, just help me relax and get you know, some more sleep at night, you know, something sweet? Well, angels can be profoundly sweet, but they do have that element of terror. If we don't understand their awesomeness, then we haven't really encountered them. They are awesome. When angels appear in the Bible, they always appear, the first thing they say is, "Fear not," because they are fearsome, you know. And so they have to say, "We're not here to destroy you, you know. Don't let our awesomeness, you know, scare you away, because we're here to tell you something." Now, people think, you know, who think in terms of angels, I'm thinking of what John Dee and his Enochian magic of dealing with angels. And there's, you know, some magicians have dealt with angels, you know, a lot of them saying, well, we're white magicians, we're dealing with the angels, not the demons, or, you know. But this thing of invoking angels, you know, if we know the names of the angels, we can invoke them and, you know, call upon them for aid and this and this. Well, you can call upon them for aid, but not directly. You have to immediately go all the way to God and say, okay, this is my prayer. But I don't know what your will is. If your will is opposed to what I pray, then not my will, but thine be done. Whereas if your will is that I overcome the, whatever particular difficulty I'm praying about, if that is your will, then my petition is that you send your angels. See, you know, if you will act directly, if that's what your choice is. But my petition is that you send the angels to guide me and to manifest the power that can clear away this darkness from my path. So you can say, let the angels appear, but you have to ask God for the angels. You can't go to them directly and try to manipulate. You know, it's so easy to fall into magic. If we know the secret names of the angels in the Enochian language, or if we know the secret number of such and such an angel in the Kabbalistic system, we can manipulate and get the angel. No, you can't do that. You know, these we can't control these beings. They're vast. And if any being comes and says, well, I am here, you summoned me, O Master, well, that's not an angel. Angels do not say, you summoned me, O Master, you know, your wish is my command. I grant you three wishes. You know who that is. That's the jinn, right? Mm-hmm. And they're lying because you're not controlling them. They, too, are more powerful than you are. They're just pretending that you're controlling them in order to hook you, you know, make you feel powerful. All of that has to go. No more magician. But the angels, I will say, it is my belief that at this point, there is a vast angelic action and power. I mean, as if the angelic legions are pouring into the subtle level of terrestrial existence to go directly to battle against the forces of Antichrist and the forces that would menace our humanity, because it is God's will that we maintain our humanity. It's also God's will that if we don't want to maintain our humanity, that he'll let the forces of darkness destroy us. But, you know, if we say, I want the human race and myself to be as you perfectly conceived of us, before time began, and because that's where my integrity is, and that's the only relationship I really have to truth. I can't relate to truth through the jinn or the UFO aliens, because they may be nice in their own world for all I know, but they're not human, so they can't help me. Whereas my humanity is perfectly preserved within the depth of your being, and that's what I turn to. So if we're willing to make that commitment, then it may come or it may not, but some of us may begin to intuit the power of the angelic armies to sweep away the darkness that is menacing the human race on every level and in every nation of the earth, in every household on the earth, in every soul, in every human body. This war is going on, and the angels are there, and the angels are in arms, and they are carrying on the fight. So how do we relate to that? We can't obviously say, well, could you stop what you're doing and do what I want? They can't do that. And how can we help them? We have no idea how we can even participate in that battle. So it is on a level that is beyond what we can usually conceive of as possible to even deal with. But what may happen if this is part of your spiritual destiny, and if it's in line with God's will, is that you will begin to intuit the power of the angelic armies and their battle that they are carrying on at this moment. And that's a lot. If you just sit there and are able to begin to see it or feel the awesomeness of it, wow, that will change things. We don't know how it will change things, but that will change things. Feel that that the angels of God are going, you know, to battle against the forces of darkness, because indeed they are. So maybe we'll just observe, like God. Like I said, God is just the observer in that battle. Maybe we'll just sit and observe. You know, who knows what will happen if we can intuit that. On the other hand, something may, not because we've called for it or defined what we want and try to get it, but something may come from that battle into our lives, and we will suddenly see we have a role. Oh, we can use you for this. Oh, you say you're ready? You say you're ready to do whatever we may say? Okay, here. And it will appear. And you'll find yourself doing something very active and with a great deal of power backing you up. But if you're going to get there, you have to completely negate all of your own agendas. You cannot use this kind of power. You can't use it, but you can make yourself available to it. And then you don't know what's going to happen. Maybe nothing but you're just an observer. We don't know what happens then. That's none of your business. But something, you know, it's a formidable thing to intuit that battle. And the final thing I want to say, which I feel a little reluctant to talk about, but I think it's time. I guess I'll say, at least for me, the intuition of the world of the angels begins at what the Hindu tantric yogis call the Brahmarandra, which is the crown of the skull. It's this little point at the top of your skull, where the fontanelles of the, you know, like the infant's skull, you know, those bones haven't grown together yet. You know, later on, when you become an adult, they grow together. Now, there are Tibetan yogis who will do a form of yoga, which has to do with raising kundalini and stuff like this, and that they will actually, those bones will begin to separate again. And it will get to the point where if someone is proficient in that form of yoga, the way that they show that they've done, you know, that they've made progress in this is they'll take a spear of grass and they'll stick it in the hole that's appeared in the top of their head and walk around, you know. Now, Kundalini yoga is dangerous, and I've been hurt by it in the past because I practiced it without guidance, and I would not say that anybody should get involved in it. I'm talking about myself. I somehow, through this point, I feel from time to time an intuition of the reality of the angels. It's as if the angelic hierarchy starts here and goes up like this. You know, it goes up wider and wider rings of the angels, up and up and up. This is the angelic world up there. That's where it appears in the subtle psychic perception, you know, of the world of the unseen, the angels. You can more or less trust, and there may be exceptions to this, so don't quote me, but you can more or less trust what comes in here, I think. So if it's possible, and I know there are a lot of people in your audience, very, a lot of clairvoyants, a lot of world-class clairvoyants, and people who are, you know, likely to have a certain degree of psychic and spiritual sensitivity. So that's why I'm saying this to you. But I have to say, don't just go off and try something. You have to see if God wants you to do this, you know, or whatever you consider God to be, whatever you consider your guidance or your higher self or whatever you want to call that. You know, see if this is right. You know, don't just do what I say, because you could get into trouble. I got into trouble, but one of the main things that probably opened this for me, Tibetan Buddhists who Vajrayana Buddhists who came to the West, a famous name back in the 70s and I guess 80s, was a Chogyam Trungpa of the, who founded Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. And, you know, he was the Tibetan Buddhist who sort of dove headfirst into the counterculture. He was, you know, I call him a berserker. It's like, a berserker is the Norse warrior who they think probably stoned on Amanita muscaria mushrooms, will get into a state of battle fury. And before the battle, he will run naked with only his sword into the ranks of the enemy and kill 40 or 50 people before they bring him down. See? And then the rest of the Vikings came, right? This was pretty effective psyops, you know what I mean? Wow. So in other words, it's that level of stuff. That's what Trungpa did. He came to the West. He didn't follow his monastic vows. He became an alcoholic. He got an automobile accident and was almost paralyzed. And he was probably in constant pain, and that's why he would drink. And yet he was an extremely advanced tantric Vajrayana yogi. So, he was going to bring this into our world at any cost, whatever the cost might be to him. And I fear whatever the cost might be to anybody else. But that was what he did, you know. And so his lineage is a Kagyupa lineage, which goes back to the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa. And the leaders of the Kagyupa lineage are a lineage of tulkus or recognized incarnations like the Dalai Lama called the Gyalwa Karmapas. The Gyalwa Karmapa, the 16th Gyalwa Karmapa, came to San Francisco, I guess it was the late 70s, and he did something called the Black Crown Ceremony. And everybody under the sun, I was there. I mean, Allen Ginsberg was there. A lot of people, in that world, and all the hippies and gay guys in their flamboyant outfits and whatever from San Francisco came to this. So what the Tibetans do is, they have things called empowerments, which means, it's not really an initiation. But it's like a reflection of initiation, the grace, the power that's developed in that yogic tradition, that they will make it available to all comers, all and sundry, which in Tibet was Buddhist faithful, who understood Buddhism and believed in it, not just anybody, like in San Francisco of the counterculture. But, and they would spread the grace of that. Of their practice and of their lineage to a wider audience, and then probably some, that were touched by that would later turn up at the monastery and say, I would like to become a monk, and ask for initiation. So he was doing this, and what he did is it was very heavy because. He was there and he had these huge guards, big, burly Tibetan guys armed with quarter staves, big, heavy sticks, to beat anybody who would, menace him, And there were the huge Tibetan horns, forget what they're called. They look like alpen horns, they're that big. And they go, the incredible sound. And all this was going on. And so he sits there and he goes into a state of meditation. You're supposed to meditate on him. And he takes off his Tibetan mitre, his red hat, and he puts on the black crown. And he's supposed to change at that moment from his human self to become a manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, or Chenrezig, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And, you know, if you can follow him in meditation, in the change he went through, you know, you will receive the grace of that wisdom. So he did this. And then afterwards, everybody comes up in a receiving line to, you know, to say hello to him, get his blessing. I just happened to have a human bone hanging around the house, which was, I believe, from a Native American source. And I used to play around with that stuff, which was very, you know, sacrilegious according to the Native Americans. You have to respect, you know, the remnants of the dead. You know, it's very important. Tibetans don't so much care. Tibetans will take a skull and cut it in half and turn it into a wine cup, you know, and drink out of the skull. They don't have that taboo, but the Native Americans certainly do. So he handed him the human bone, and he did this blessing where he just puts his fist on the crown of your skull and goes, you know, boom. And that opens the Brahmarandra, opens the door at the crown of the skull. So, and, you know, that led to some very deep dreams and such. And so in a certain sense, that was a part of my initiation into the ability to intuit the angelic worlds above the head, which I don't always do. And it's funny, you know, it's like, that's not what we do in Sufism. But that was an influence that I cannot deny. You know, it came to me, it taught me something. And since it came to me through the Tibetan Buddhists, you know, spreading something to whoever comes, I think it may be, God willing, appropriate for me to pass it on to whoever is listening, because this is not a special initiatory secret. This is just, you know, what the Tibetans did for everybody. So there are undoubtedly other channels through which you can come to that intuition of the angelic. And certainly angels are so important in Islam. You know, I mean, the Quran was given to Muhammad through Angel Gabriel. And, you know, the existence of angels is one of the articles of faith of Islam. And there are well-attested hadith that talk about the angels fighting on the side of the Muslims in the early battle. So, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. You know, this is part of my tradition as well as other traditions. So, but if you're going to turn to the angels first, understand they are awesome. They're not to be trifled with. And secondly, you know, always turn to God or whatever you consider to be the ultimate highest source. Kitty, kitty. The highest source first, don't because otherwise, you know, you turn the angels into familiar spirits. I remember there were some new age guys who were talking to each other. I forget where I saw this. One says to the other, "What's your favorite angel?" You know, mine's Raphael. You know, oh, mine's Michael. Your favorite angel. You know, don't screw around with it. These are awesome beings, and it's only your submission to God's will and you're turning to the highest source for guidance that gives you any right to look into the angelic world. And if you don't do that, looking into the angelic world could be extremely dangerous for you. So start with God and then see if the angels form a part of your destiny. But, and if they do, because remember, they are at war against the forces of darkness at this very moment. And at least we might do well to observe that battle, whether or not we become involved.
It's a very beautiful story, Charles. I appreciate it. It does remind me of a time in my life, 50 years ago, over 50 years ago, when I felt like I needed to make a major change. I had been touched by the divine. I've written about it. Many people know the story when my great uncle Harry appeared to me in a dream, and I woke up from the dream with just tears of joy. It was so powerful, and I was singing a sacred song from the Jewish tradition, and I later learned that Uncle Harry died at that moment. And after that, I spent months agonizing over how I can realign my life to be consistent with that experience. And it was very difficult because I was a graduate student in criminology at the time, doing group therapy with murderers and rapists at San Quentin Prison. But eventually, after months of agony, I had a certainty one day that the answer was going to come in a dream that night. I just knew, tonight I'm going to have the dream. Tonight there will be the answer. And I had a strange dream. It was so strange. The only way I could figure it out was to act it out. And I did. I woke up and did what I had done in the dream, which was to visit a particular house where my friends lived and knock on their door, and there was no one there, and I found a key as I had done in the dream and walked into the living room. There in the middle of the living room, just as I had dreamt, was a magazine. And as I was paging through the magazine, it dawned on me to do what I'm doing today, 50 years later, interviewing people in effect. And it was, which was the last thing on my mind at that time. I didn't own a radio or TV. I didn't believe in radios or any form of electronic communication. But after that, I changed my mind, and it set me on the path I can now look back on 50 years later and say, I'm following whatever guidance was given to me then. It was so strong, it was good for 50 years.
Well, you say you give up all of your agendas. Now, you have to see just what that means, because if people look at the formidable darkness that is menacing the human race, and then they're told, well, you need to give up all your agendas, there's a tendency to say, oh, well, yeah, what are you going to do? There's nothing you can do. Yeah, I'll just turn it all over to God and go watch TV. You know, I'll let him do it, you know, because I don't know, far be it from me to figure out how to deal with this mess. And you know, there's a great deal of fear, and you want to distract yourself, you want to hide, and you become weirdly passive. I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a strange, almost zombie apocalypse thing happening to people now, just out of the shock of all the things that are going on. It's like when Trump was, you know, when you know, he caught his ear and ducked, you know, and the Secret Service jumped on him to protect him. There were people sitting behind him, and they just said, oh, I wonder what that was. Scratching their heads, you know. I mean, the normal thing would be to realize that he'd just been shot at, and to scatter and get out of the line of fire. But nobody did that. You know, they were passive. I mean, there's a great dangerous passivity coming over people, I think. And this means that the only people with any initiative ultimately are going to be the psychopaths if we don't watch out. You know, we have to be ready, willing, and able to take action. And giving up all of our agendas doesn't mean we're not ready, willing, and able to take action. It means We are waiting for the command. When the command comes, we got to be ready to do it. You know, we've got to have that tendency. And yet at the same time, say, you know, I'm not going to push any of my agendas. I'm not going to, you know, try to make something happen that I think should happen. That's God's job to say what's supposed to happen. But when the command comes, I'm ready. And that's a little difficult. That's one thing that Islam probably is preeminent in. I saw this Lion of the Desert. It was that movie with Anthony Quinn, where he was playing an anti-colonial freedom fighter in North Africa against the Italians. You know, the Italians were colonizing someplace, and you just see him as like a country teacher or imam, running a little masjid, a little school for kids, and teaching them their Muslim ABCs, you know. And he, obviously he's just totally content in that life. He's not a, you know, an activist running around looking for a cause to fight. And he's just, you know, doing his thing. But then obviously it becomes necessary to defend his nation against the Italians. So suddenly he's a warrior. You know, he just, okay, that's what I am to do. And he becomes, you know, a preeminent warrior, you know, and a powerful and competent. And you know, very strong, you know, reliable and formidable warrior. And then the time comes, you know, he loses and he says, oh, well, I lost. So I guess that's all over. And he just says, fine. And he doesn't struggle against the fate of having lost. He said, you know, God wanted me to teach children their ABCs. God wanted me to be a vet. You know, heroic freedom fighter. God wanted me to accept defeat, you know, so God's will be done. And you saw somehow Anthony Quinn could perfectly render that willingness to follow God's will, however it turns, you know, and he did that so well. And that's what's good about Islam. And it's not just in Islam, but that's one thing you can see as a preeminent Muslim virtue is that ability, which means, you know, you're not always looking for a fight. In fact, you're looking for peace. That's why we say, you know, assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you. But you're at peace with whatever God wills. It's not peace. I'm just looking for easy circumstances or protection or safety. You know, it's not that you're at peace with God's will. So, you know, if it's time to fight, you fight. If it's time to lay down your arms, you lay them down. If it's time, you know, to go back to teaching children their ABCs, that's what you do. That's what you do. And so, you know, it's good to see that. It's good to realize that Islam has those virtues. It's not, certainly it's not every Muslim that's able to, actualize those virtues without doubt, but that's one of the ideals in our religion.
Once again, beautifully put. It does remind me, however, of being in Muslim countries and noticing that people drive their automobiles like crazy. It seemed to me to be very reckless ways and with the attitude of, inshallah, if God wills it, I'll be safe. If he wills it, I'll have an accident. It's out of my control.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that's the highest expression of that virtue, right? Like a maniac. That virtue can be understood on a lot less useful levels. The word Islam and the word salam, which means peace, are from the same root. Salam doesn't just mean peace in the sense of the absence of conflict. It's peace in the sense of perfection and flawlessness. You know, because when something is flawless, there's no struggle within it. It is perfectly what it is. You know, and that is peace. Also, the idea is the only legitimate purpose for struggle, armed struggle or intellectual struggle or anything else, is to achieve a state of peace. So if you go down that road, there's going to be endless conflict for generations. No, you know, if you can balance the situation with a strong intervention of force, do it. But if it is going to lead you into endless conflict, you know, then don't do it. You know, and it takes a lot of discernment to see the line between those two different things. You know? But in any case, I'm just the last thing I know that I want to say. This is from my epic poem, The Wars of Love. I wrote this years and years ago, 30 years ago. This was my feeling about jihad at that point. This is before I'd become a Muslim. But this is what I said. I say all will be pressed into service. I say all will be required to fight. The passive, the coward, the innocent will be trampled down unless locked in single combat with Antichrist in mountain solitude and stillness. Invoke, therefore, the war in your marrow. Call on the fight you were born with, that enemy whose lie is cut and tooled precisely to cover your single truth. Pick targets. Each man is alone with all men in this night of war. The conglomerate form of death stands guard on each human door, solid to the bullet and the chisel, like those cliffs in the Sinai, in which our skirmishers discovered, still living, the imprisoned forms of men. That was that. And later I realized I was probably writing about St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai, which is like a little fortress. It's one of the oldest monasteries in the world. It's Greek Orthodox. Within the walls of this monastery, which is still there, there's a mosque, strangely enough, because pilgrims, you know, before the Crusades in the earlier years, when they went on the Hajj, you know, on the Muslim pilgrimage, they wouldn't just go to Mecca and Medina. They would, if they could afford it, go to many different sacred sites in the Near East, one of them being, of course, Mount Sinai. And so Muslim pilgrims would come to Mount Sinai, and so the monks built them a little mosque within their own monastery so that they would have a place to worship. So, and the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, the first of his covenants of protection that were issued to the Christians of the world was issued to those monks, because he used to be the story told by the Bedouins of the area and by the monks, though not in a lot of other Muslim sources. There's allusions to it. You know, you could have to piece it together, but it's not a major part of the Prophet's sirah or his biography. But the local Bedouins and the local Christian monks tell that Muhammad, well, as we know, that before the Quran descended upon him through the angel Gabriel, he was a caravan leader. He was he worked in the business operations of his wife Khadija. And so he would, you know, lead caravans all over the Near East trading and, you know, this. And one of the places he supplied was that monastery. I don't know what they produced there that he was trading for, but whatever, you know. So that was one of his stops in Sinai. And apparently once he was resting under, you know, the shade of a wall, and above him came, this is the story, legend, you know, is all we know, was an eagle. An eagle came and hovered above him. And one of the monks came out and looked at that and said, this is interesting. This is significant. So he went in and talked to the abbot or the other monks, and they invited him in to the monastery and said, well, we consider that this was an omen of great things to come in your future. And those monks were not the only ones who recognized Muhammad's prophethood or potential prophethood before it ever came to him. There are other monks who said, you know, you will be preeminent in your generation or whatever they said. And he didn't see it. He says, I'm just a caravan leader. And I said, we want from you a treaty or a letter or something that grants your protection to this monster. And he said, I can't grant protection to anybody. I'm just a caravan leader. Well, he says, well, humor us, they said, just we'll write a few things and tell you what, because he couldn't read, tell you what they are. And you just put your handprint, put your handprint on this piece of paper, piece of parchment, whatever it was, and, granting us protection. And later on, when the Muslims unexpectedly to Muhammad, I'm sure, suddenly within a generation, were able to take over half the known world. Phenomenal power in that expansion. And so, they were coming into the area of the Sinai and Egypt. And so at that point, this is called the Ashtiname, which is the first of the prophet's covenants with the Christians of the world. And it was kind of renegotiated and a longer text was written. And it was signed by Ali and a number of future caliphs, and it granted them that protection. And this became the template for the prophet's covenants, which were granted to many different Christian groups, in the marches and in the outer borders of the Byzantine Empire, and also to some Jewish groups, and also to Zoroastrians. And they all seem to go back or have elements of the original document which he granted to those monks. These documents which say, no Muslim until the end, every Muslim until the end of time is commanded to protect Christians. That is your duty. You are not to rob them. You are not to excessively tax them. You're not to damage their buildings. Certainly, you're not to kill them. If Christian churches fall into disrepair, it would be a pious act for Muslims to help the Christians rebuild their churches. And you can see how that was, in the same spirit as the monks of St. Catherine's building a mosque within their walls for the Muslim pilgrims, And if your Christian wife wants to go to church, don't create problems for her, Don't oppress her. Let her do it. Let her take, instruction from the Christian elders. And then, these were documents which became the basis, among many other things, of the policy of the Ottoman Empire toward religious minorities. They used to be studied by the U.S. diplomatic corps because we had to deal with the Ottomans. We had to know what the covenants were all about. This has almost been forgotten. Recently, a new book has been written on the covenants. I forget its title, by a couple of people from the Hamid bin Khalifa University in Qatar, Ahmed Al-Wakil and Professor Zain. And that book was just presented to Pope Francis, So I was involved for 7 years between 2013, 2020 in the work of rediscovering and bringing these covenants forward to the world. And this was just at the time when ISIS was coming up. And these covenants say generally anyone who controverts these covenants has earned the curse of God and his prophet. And that was pointed directly at what ISIS was doing. We believe that they were going around to various ancient monasteries in the Near East and Iraq and, destroying the monasteries, killing the monks, in also an attempt to eradicate these documents so they would never be known. But luckily, so many of them, which were kept in archives of St. Catherine's Monastery were digitalized, and sent to the West, and that they've been saved in electronic form. So, this was the drama we went through as ISIS was coming up. So that's an example of, I didn't think I was going to do anything like that. This is all the research of Dr. John Andrew Morrow, you know, who's a Muslim brother of mine, and he's a Metis, which is like a that's basically means half breed, you know, from Quebec, you know, who is mixed European and Native American ancestry, and there's a certain legal status that people like him have in under Canadian law. I don't know exactly how that works, but he converted to Islam as a teenager, and he just single-handedly did immense scholarship to bring these things back into human memory. And we did 7 years of serious struggle around this. I ended up writing a document called War on Five Fronts, a Comprehensive Plan to Defeat ISIS, because an Iranian-American businessman who knew other billionaires, you know, he was a billionaire or a multi-millionaire, was about to see, meet with Donald Trump's team right after the election. And so he said he would hand to the Trump people this document. I never had the courage to ask him whether he actually did. But what I wanted to do is get that document to Trump so he would see that Muslims were coming up with a plan to defeat ISIS, because we felt that ISIS was destroying our religion from within, you know. And so he needed to know that. It might head off whatever anti-Muslim pogroms he might be thinking about, you know. And so I don't know if that ever had an effect, but it was pretty dramatic, all of this, you know. And but I never knew that this would happen. I thought that my activist life was over, you know. I just said, well, everything I can see in the activist world is crazy, and it's all contradictory, and it's all destructive. You know, I'm just going to fold my hands and go back to my cave and meditate, or whatever you say. But then, no, I was tapped. You know, something came and said, here, do it. And I said, oh, yes. And then when the 7 years was over and COVID came and everything got locked down, the word came and said, well, that's over. And there are other people who are carrying it on, and then once in a while they report back to us, but we're not doing anything anymore to speak of. And that's the way things are, you know. When you ask, you know, ask for God's will, he could hand you something completely unexpected, and then he'd take it away. And you know, you don't identify with it. If the time for that is over, it's over. Fine, you know. So that's an example of what may come if one looks in on the battles of the angels. Who knows? Who knows? We don't know what will come.
That's a very inspiring story. And synchronistically, I've been in communication with Dr. Morrow today.
Ah! Incredible. So what are you going to interview him on this stuff?
I suggested to him, I would ask you for guidance. And without me having to ask, you've already provided it.
Well, see, okay, let's look at this as an example of how things really happen. Usually we think we're doing it, we're planning it, we talk to figure it out, how to do this, talk to this person, you know, come up with this. But it is all, you know, it's all being inspired and directed from the invisible world. And usually we can't see into that world because we're supposed to have faith. You know, if we expect to have a dream or a vision every time we're supposed to, you know, raise our finger to do anything, it's not going to work. You know, you got to trust and go ahead, even if you don't know the whole story. But this is a perfect illustration. And I hope what I've said about angelic action can build a bridge between, you know, your conception and you know what you've been concentrating on in your life and what Dr. Morrow's been up to, because it is inspiring. I mean, things were happening with him. he would find covenants, you know, that have never been heard of before, just in the process of this. And, he kept saying, it's incredible, I was just doing this. And, you know, and another one appeared, you know, they were being given to him from somewhere else, you know. And so maybe, you know, I mean, he doesn't usually talk about the spacey aspects of it like I do, but he might have something to say.
Well, Charles, once again, it's a pure delight for me to be with you and to partake of your wisdom. One of our commenters recently, and many of them keep saying, bring him back, but one of them wrote recently, Charles Upton is a deep thinker, and there are very few deep thinkers around. So I want to thank you again and again for being with me and the New Thinking Aloud audience.
My poetic mentor, Lou Welch, Beat Generation poet Lou Welch, who ended up as an alcoholic suicide, had a poem in which he lamented, he says, full of my gift, I'm often left out and afraid. So, you know, he gave a great deal, but man, you know, you can't give unless people want to receive. All if people are listening, you end up saying things you never had any idea you would say, because that's the other part of this. It's a circuit, and the other part of the circuit is necessary. You know, the more people listen, the more true. If they listen with sincerity and desire for the truth, the more true speech appears, you know, to satisfy their need. That's the way things go.
Which is why I conclude each of these interviews by thanking our audience and reminding them that they are the reason that we are here.
Yes. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your need. I mean, the Sufis say our connection with God is our need. If we had no need, how could we relate to God? You know, it says God is the rich and you are the poor. Well, the rich is overflowing with the need to give, and the poor, you know, is hungry and you know, profoundly sunk in the need to receive. You know, being hungry and greedy is way different than being hungry and believing, you know, that the bounty of God is just one heartbeat away.
Three in the New Thinking Aloud dialogue series is UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.